Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. My name is Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic. I'm going to laugh through this by my coworkers, Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza. And then we also have our producer, Rissa, is present around and a mic as well. And we're going to talk books. It's fall. We're just coming out of a Halloween. So this is kind of a November edition. We've got a kind of a wide range of topics and titles for today. So I don't know, we kind of want to jump in with kind of the odd. We've all we all have our weird reading journeys. We find things different ways. Who wants to start this one?
I'll start in with this. We're in planning the podcast. We talk a little bit before we kind of meet briefly just to see what we're going to talk about. And since we don't do themes anymore, I think that's actually been a nice change. Our old podcast, we did that, and that was interesting in its own way. But this way, we're all just coming to books sort of organically. And one of the ways that we all came to this first set is, actually for two of us, is really through like committee work or work outside, you know, work for a conference or a, you know, like a professional development conference. And the other one is a committee that you will hear about in the next probably 6 months and is a community read type committee. So we're just sort of screening books for that type of thing. And it's actually a book that I'm going to talk about that Jessica talked about first. And I waffled on whether or not to bring the book again, because we already talked about it a little bit. But I just wanted to talk about it briefly because
It's called great book.
It really is. It's called I Cheerfully Refuse by Leif Enger. And many of our listeners may know Leif Enger because of Peace Like a River. He's also had a number of wonderful books since then. But Peace Like a River, I actually read years ago as part of the Holt book discussion group when I was the library head there. And one thing I can say about Leif Enger's books is that they're very cinematic, and that was made into a movie. I can see that again with this one. And they're rollicking. I thought he was a Western author, because the first book does, Peace Like a River, does have that a Western kind of theme. But actually he's a Midwestern author, Minnesota. And I feel like this book is just infused with the Midwest. In particular, at its heart, while it is a very difficult Orphean tragedy, and it was inspired by him reading the Orphean story when he was a little kid. And he was so struck by the beauty of the tragedy that he incorporated it into the story years later as an adult. But I feel like the heart of this is this incredibly Midwestern story of grief and of community and of the healing power of community. The thing I really liked about this is it's a dystopian novel, which I can honestly say I've never read a dystopian novel. I'm not as much of a fiction reader, although this year I have. But what I liked about the dystopia is that, if you can like dystopia, is that it's never spelled out, like it never slaps you in the face, right? He's never like, this asteroid hit or this huge plague happened and this. It's more like creepy. It's on the edges. It comes into the story, and the author never sits down and tells you this has happened now, but you can see what has changed. And at first you can't even see it at all. It's like, oh, it's just a normal story. This man really loves his wife. He's a bass player. His name is Rainey. You instantly like him. You instantly like his wife, Lark, who is a bookseller, but you realize that bookselling is dangerous. There aren't books published anymore. So it's really like about 50 turns away from our society right now, if you can put it that way. We've got climate change. We have wind gusts that come out of nowhere. Extreme, strange weather, warming lakes. This is set in Icebridge, which is a fictional Michigan community. So warm that old bodies are coming up from the lake. But it becomes this the story about being hunted in this crime that he really didn't commit. He's sort of implicated into this sort of terrifying crime situation. And he ends up going on this journey to sort of to find his wife, who is dead. So it's like a mythical journey, but it incorporates all these amazing characters, and you learn more about the dystopia. And just was really compelling. And I cared so much about him. you feel so much for this guy. He's like this big, great bear of a guy, this sweet bass player. He's kind of he lives a kind of a simple life. He's reconciled himself to the changes in society to some degree, and he's trying to find a good life among it, and he just loves his wife. And it just rips your heart out what, mm-hmm. you know, she's taken from him. And you just care so much, and you want to see him succeed. Mm-hmm. But there's so much in here with drug addiction, environmental mm-hmm. collapse, oligarchy, people in society that are, you know, invested in space, who are the wealthy people, sort of an indentured servitude. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm. A triumph of an anti-reading sentiment.
Yes.
Anti-education. Anti-education.
An illiterate head of state who is mm-hmm. proud of it. So there's a lot going on, but it's again, it's never hits you in the head like this is what happened. It's creepy. It's yeah. sort of sinister. It's around the edges, which makes it even more compelling. Mm-hmm. And it is quite a dark story, and yep. it's breathless and scary, and I really couldn't put it down.
But it's also weirdly hopeful, and
yes,
I mean it is
absolutely.
Somebody described it as one of the most hopeful
yeah.
dystopias out there,
right?
Like
right.
The hopeful dystopia yeah. they'd ever read. I can't remember who said it, but
it's
yeah.
sort of like, how do you move on when everything is shattered?
Right.
Can you move on? And so in that way, it's sort of prescriptive and healing. So mm-hmm. yeah. So okay. thank you for bringing it to the podcast,
yes.
and
yeah.
just something I recommend people check out if they haven't yet this year.
What do you think? You or me? Me? Okay. So the one that I picked up for this kind of go around is I had been invited to moderate an author panel, and it's sort of a kind of a kitchen sink fantasy panel. So it's like a wide range of different kinds of fantasy top titles. But the one that caught my eye, and I'd already sort of seen it, both of us actually had seen it, it's The Witches of El Paso by Luis Jaramillo. It's a story of motherhood. It's a story of legacy and magic. It features these two characters. One's this grounded, sort of established, sensible lawyer in a struggling legal aid firm. And then the other main character is her great aunt, who's this wild, vivid, magical character. It's her elderly great aunt, Nana. It's set in and around El Paso in colonial times, so El Paso del Norte, and then in 1943, and then in the now. And it kind of comes to a head when Nana has been living by herself. She's older, she's getting frail, her memory's a little bit questionable from Marta, the lawyer's point of view. But she has a kitchen fire. They're really worried about her staying on her own. So she takes her home, and so Nana's now living with her. But she sees something in the house when she's at the house in the burn, and she just doesn't, it's like the soot on the wall is there, and then the wall's not there, and then it's back again. And Nana's sort of kind of, you know, in all of this, as things go on, Nana's like, you're coming into your magic. And Marta is not a believer, but she is curious. And she also is trying to keep Nana kind of happy. You know, her husband kind of wants to put her into a home. Marta doesn't quite really want to do that. Nana wants Marta to help her find, she kind of comes clean about some family secrets. And one of the secrets is that she had a daughter, and she wants to find that daughter. What she doesn't understand is that at a point in her life, Nana crossed through time back to colonial Mexico,
Whoa.
And that's where she had her daughter.
Okay.
So she really needs Marta to come into her magic. And
Tough.
Yes, so it's quite it's a very in some ways it's a very practical story. In other ways, there's that bit of magic to it that's quite interesting. But it is a lot. It sort of looks at sisterhood, motherhood, the stories we tell, the secrets we keep, and it's just an interesting story. And it's he's a known writer, but this is a first novel, and it's just a very well written story.
Very cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, this wasn't in the script, but I immediately thought of like telenovelas and stories from Mexico. There are a few, which of course the titles escape me, of these colonial set Mexican soap operas. Mm-hmm. And I just had this thought, like, what if there was time travel in those soap operas? That would be amazing. Awesome. I'll have to mention that to my mom and see what she thinks as we watch these things together. This would have been maybe 2 or 3 years ago, actually. I don't watch a lot of TV, but I was, you know, kind of surfing through my 3 or 4 PBS options one night, and I came across this show or documentary on George Nakashima. He was an American wood crafter. Artist, I would say, who made the most incredible pieces of furniture that I have seen. And they're kind of a blend of like Shaker influence and Japanese influence. He was born in Washington. And I just always remember these images of the wood. It was just so clean and so, I guess, natural is the way I would put it. And the reason that stood out to me is because as I've grown up, I'm someone who, you know, likes to go on Facebook Marketplace, and I have a ton of, I wouldn't say a ton, but several pieces of mismatched furniture. And I really like the clean edges and just the natural look of wood. Mm-hmm. And anyway, when I was searching for more biographies or nonfiction books for children for our Capillary District Library's collection, and I came across Listening to Trees, George Nakashima, Woodworker. This is by Holly Thompson, and the pictures are by Toshiki Nakamura. I was like, wow, I can't wait to get this in our building so I can read it. This is a really lovely book that touches on George's philosophy of just giving dignity to fallen trees, fallen pieces of wood that, you know, you find in the forest. He was someone who grew up in Washington State and liked to travel in Oregon and Washington to, I guess you could say, tree bathe or forest bathe, just taking in those beautiful images of just hiking and wearing holes, you know, in your shoes. He trained as a forestry professional, but primarily as an architect, and went on, this was way back in the 30s and the 40s, went on to spend time in Japan, where his parents were from, I believe. He spent time in India. And when he came back during World War II, he eventually spent some time in one of the camps in Idaho, the Japanese-American internment camps. And while there, he was really influenced by someone to capture his Japanese heritage with the joint working of wood and how to connect pieces of wood to give them longevity, but also just, again, those clean lines. If you look online, you will see a lot of his pieces do have that Shaker influence, but you see these joints that are just very unique. Mm-hmm. He ended up kind of forming this woodworkers, I guess I would say, like complex. He just built all these buildings, and he had a number of workers. This place in New Hope, Pennsylvania, still is going on, and they build these beautiful pieces of furniture, which are very unique and, of course, very expensive. But if you have a chance, I would highly recommend that you head on to even the Smithsonian website, where there's a few pieces in their collection or their George Nakashima Woodworkers website is also, he's passed away, but just lovely pieces of furniture and a lovely way of just looking at wood and giving trees their respect, their dignity, I guess, if you could put it in that way. Just one more thing about the book is that it's written in what is called, I think it was Bashu who was a poet from the 1600s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In this form of haibun, form of poetry, it's just beautiful, where you've got like several lines combined with prose on the opposite. So you've got like maybe half a ton, 10 feet across, a table for peace on earth. That was the spread on one of his last projects. It was on, you know, he just came across this huge piece of wood and decided to, you know, try to make seven what he called altars that would be spread around the world, different places to, as a meeting place to help people come together to make, mm-hmm. make peace in our various connections. And I don't think that all seven were completed yet, but his daughter, the people who are after him are still working on it.
How beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
Beautiful.
I saw that book come in. I didn't know you were, and then you said you were going to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I need to see that book. Yeah. It just looks gorgeous.
Yes, definitely.
How wonderful that children get these stories. I don't feel like, I mean, we had lovely children's books in our era, but not like that. Maybe we did, but
yeah.
I don't really think so.
I
was like a heavy user of the library as a little kid,
yeah.
especially in school. And I don't remember the nonfiction being this magical like
well,
that.
Well, I think because it's a picture book, it's yeah. just really inviting, and
yeah.
you get to learn a little bit about someone or something mm-hmm. with these picture book nonfiction entries.
Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful thing in publishing now that we have these books.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Sorry to keep going on, but I also want to mention The Soul of a Tree, A Woodworker's Reflections. This book was actually written in the 1980s, and it's by George himself, and just a lovely
okay.
book. We don't
nice.
Own it, but you could get it in Mel. Lots of photographs there, too. Just
gorgeous.
Amazing
okay.
meditations.
Okay. We talked about we used to do themes. We don't actually do themes, but we find themes
yeah.
in the titles that we do want to talk about. And it just so happens that we did, Mani and I both have a couple of titles by Indigenous authors that we wanted to talk about. It is Native American Heritage Month in November. And I think I'm going to start because I think everybody always needs to know if Robin Wall Kimmerer has a new book coming out.
Yay.
And she does. So, The Service Berry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World is a book that I had the pleasure of getting as an advanced reading copy. I really, really want to see the finished product because I think it's going to be very much not a gift book in that to take away from the story, but just a well-packaged, pretty book. I mean, it is an illustrated it's actually a long essay. It's on reciprocity and the potential of a gift economy, kind of in the face of our unsustainable models, which we are living in right now. It's illustrated by the analogous natural systems that create the service berry and its ecosystem. So it's, you know, it's all the pieces and parts of how we work together and can work together and depend on each other and could at least supplement our current ecosystem better with a gift economy or more of exchanges instead of, you know, the so very capitalist focused
yeah.
must
yeah.
Money.
Build the wealth.
Everything's
type.
Money.
Yeah, everything's money thing.
Unbridled consumerism.
So it's totally. So this is just, it's one of those things where this is the IndieNext pick, top IndieNext pick. It made the Library Reads picks. And as I am a board member for Library Reads, this is sort of the library equivalent of IndieNext. We are always so desperate to get nonfiction onto the list. And this one got on. I mean, everybody recognizes that
yeah.
the importance of this message, and Robin's writings, and it's just one of the things that I want people to know about. The other title I have is Thunder Songs Essays by Sasha Takshablu Lapointe. I listened to this. It's a wonderful collection of autobiographical essays. By Kosalish Two-Spirit punk and author. Sasha LaPointe, and she touches on Indigenous identity, displacement, stereotypes, that never-ending, like, all Indians are gone, they don't really exist anymore. It's like, I don't know any. They are here, they're around, they have a powerful and deep culture that still exists. And it's all very tied, it's all tied very closely to the anthropological work of her great-grandmother in trying to maintain the Coastal Salish culture and languages and that sort of thing. So it kind of jumps around. It's sort of an essay on becoming, accepting, standing in your identity. But it's just, it was a really powerful read. It begins and ends with stories of your grandmother. But it touches on big stories, and it's because I know what's coming with Madi's book. It's, you know, she talks about the missing, she talks about the abused. She has an earlier memoir called Red Paint, the ancestral autobiography of a Coast Salish punk, and I have not read that, and I would really like to go back and read it. That came out in 22. This book is long listed for the Andrew Carnegie Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction this year, so that's another reason I wanted to bring it back up. I actually read it much earlier and was sort of holding on to it for this. But I just think people should know about it. And if you look at the cover, it's the one of the brightest books we've had out this year.
Pretty.
But it's you know, she is of a younger generation, and that is clear, but it's just a very thoughtful, interesting look at Indigenous identity now, and yeah.
Wow. Thank you. Well, the J fiction, middle grade fiction that I have to recommend is Find Her by Ginger Reno. This is her debut middle grade fiction book. She has written a picture book, but this is a tough story in many ways. Ren is a 12-year-old. She's living in Fort Gibson, Oklahoma. She's Cherokee. I should say half Cherokee because her father is white, and he's the local police chief in town. She has her grandmother, who is in Cherokee, called Elisi. And her grandmother plays a big, big part in her life. But one of the things that's notable right away is that she talks about her missing mother, her mother who's gone away 5 years ago. And it seems like people are beginning to give up on trying to find her. They don't know what's happened. One of the things I'll point out right now, if you don't get a chance to see the cover, there is a handprint of blood on this child's face. And I don't know if it's a symbol.
A symbol. Yes, very much a symbol.
But it's very jarring to see that. Like, it's, in my mind, kind of like, wow, watch yourself if you're a woman, especially if you're Indigenous in some of these areas of reservations or just really anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, Mexico, obviously. A lot of women from Mexico also go missing. But that is, I'm just like, wow, to have a child constantly be thinking. But Ren is, you know, constantly researching, trying to find her mother. She's sad that her police chief father seems to have given up a bit. But she's, there are some other donors in the book, which I'll get to in a minute. But what I'll say is that the grandmother, Elisi, is really principal in her life to help her put all this in perspective, but also brings humor and love and care to her. Elisi's world-famous tomato basil soup, which later on they say is actually from Campbell's or McCann. But that's how they always put things. It's just like, well, you know, now it's my turn to treat you, Elisi. I'm going to get you Ren's world-famous pan pizza from such-and-such pizza place. It's just, so it kind of made me laugh that they really put things with a lot of terms of endearment for one another. The other thing that I think should be mentioned is that there are themes of animal abuse. There's a major mystery in the book. It doesn't kind of get started really until towards the middle. But Wren uses her, she's part of the Wolf Clan, her skills to try to figure out what is going on with all these animals that are being found. And I was really moved by just the sense of, you know, despair that could exist for communities where lots of women go missing. Ginger Reno gives, there's several organizations that try to support and bring attention to this. And the last thing I'll say, really, is if you are looking for an interesting picture book that gives some perspective to what happens in Canada and the U.S., it's a graphic novel, If I Go Missing, by Brianna Johnny. I think these are things we can know about and learn to bring more attention to.
Yeah. Wow.
It is it's one of the early stories, one of the early essays in Sasha LaPointe's book, Basket Woman. And it's the Basket Woman story is a kind of it's kind of to keep women aware of what's going on around them. But she talks about kind of, the handprint is one symbol, but the red dresses are another. You see the red dresses hanging in trees is another
I have seen that,
symbol
yes.
of the missing. And it is horribly common. And not that nobody's doing anything, but I just never feel like anybody's doing enough.
Mm. And that we're not hearing about it more, you know, that... this was a long time ago, and I can't think of the movie, but an actor, the one who had the big snowplow accident that kind of changed his life.
Jeremy Renner.
Yes, him.
Yes.
He did a film precisely because he was like, I want to call attention to this issue. And there was, you know, that was the main part of the movie. I wish I could think of it.
Hopefully we'll put it in the
We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the notes.
But yeah, I just, like, why don't we hear about these things in the Detroit Free Press? Or, I mean, maybe I am. Maybe I'm missing it. Sorry, Detroit Free Press.
I
think MSU may have done did MSU do something earlier this year with the red dresses? They may have.
I think
you're right, yes.
Okay. Hmm. Oh, wow. Well, I'm going to switch gears from that very important topic to something else. We've been asking our Facebook followers a question. You know, there are several questions a month, but we try to have a book question that is asked each month. And this last month was National Cookbook Month. And the question was, what is your most must-have cookbook for the kitchen? And it was really fun to see the responses. We had many repeat votes for the Betty Crocker cookbooks. The Joy of Cooking was mentioned repeatedly. And then several responses about family recipes from sort of a general family heirloom cookbook being mentioned to a specific mention of a cookbook by someone's mother and someone's grandmother. And then there were a few repeat responses for Moosewood cookbooks, America's Test Kitchen cookbooks. And then specifically, I can't mention all the cookbooks that were listed here, but a few were Food Lab by Kenji Lopez-Alt, Baking Yesteryear by B. Dylan Hollis. Oh, that was a really fun book last year. Treasures of the Mexican Table by Patty Ginich, and she has several cookbooks in our system, but that was mentioned. And then one we don't have, but I found in Mel, and I remember seeing this a number of years ago. It looked really cool. It's 12 Months of Monastery Soups. And I was just thinking about this book, like, last week. It was so weird, and I hadn't seen this yet, so it was just odd. It's really fun to get these questions asked and see what our Facebook followers recommend. It's really, really fun. Mm-hmm. And then just wanted to ask the two of you if you have anything you want to mention or cookbooks that you've been enjoying.
So the fun thing about that question was is that when I first moved out, my mother gave me a Betty Crocker cookbook. So that was one. Another part of it is that one of the ways, and this is me putting on my genealogist hat on, one of the neat ways that my family has sort of kind of kept stories together is that my aunt spearheaded putting together a family cookbook. Cool. So we have this cookbook that she periodically will add extra pages to and send us the pages. It's now kind of in a rather large three-ring binder. And it's just full of family stories and favorite recipes. And that one's the one that I probably go back to the most because it's all of our favorites are in there.
Nice.
But also, I'm kind of maybe late to the game. I was very aware of her when she was kind of first popular, but I've started going back and looking at Molly Yeh's recipe books. I quit cable, but have the Discovery app. So I'm kind of limited watching, but I've been watching some of those cooking shows, and I find her fascinating in that she's a Juilliard-trained musician who's with her also Juilliard-trained husband to a farm in the Midwest, and that's where he raises, I can't remember what he raises, because I want to say beets, and I'm not for sure if that's the case. But they have a farm, a strong working farm, and she has a very Midwest and easy, laid-back cooking style, which I can't handle much more than that. But she also is infusing his Midwest heritage with her Jewish and Chinese background, too, so that it's just and New York kind of-ish upbringing. So it's a neat range of recipes, but also easy recipes, again, which is all I can handle.
Which is helpful.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, well, it's Thanksgiving time, and one of the books that has really influenced my little bit of cooking that I do is Fit for Life. It's by Marilyn and Harvey Diamond. We're going way back to the 1980s. It's kind of a combination of, like, you know, you should eat like this sort of book, but it's got really good recipes, and one of them is green beans with thyme and garlic and lemon, and I've made that for years to take to our family party or family dinner, and it's just like, wow, that's really a good one.
Sounds so really good.
Yeah.
Wow.
They introduced me to a lot of vegetables I never used to eat. So
that's really cool.
Yep. I actually have a cookbook as well.
Yeah.
I was gifted this for Christmas last year, and it was so awesome, with like a giant wok and some cutlery and some lemon olive oil, which I must add, the Meyer lemon olive oil changed my life. But this cookbook is called Let's Eat, 101 Recipes to Fill Your Heart and Home by Dan Pelosi. I guess he runs a pretty popular Instagram called Grossy Pelosi, and he's on Good Morning America and all these things.
Okay.
And,
Good Morning America.
It's on Mel or Libby. We don't have it in the library, but it's great. It's like hearty Italian family meals, and
nice.
It touches everything, desserts and just everything's in there, and it talks a lot about his family and like making like the familial significance of all of these meals in the book. So I really, really enjoyed it. And everything is like, I mean, indulgent, like all the photos and everything. You're just like, I know if I eat that, I'm going to be full for 3 days. So
awesome.
Yep.
It's really wonderful.
Sounds great. I love cookbooks. I think I've talked about them a lot on the podcast, but I'm also the nonfiction selector, so I select a lot of cookbooks, and I just think they've gotten better and better and better. And I know that, like, online, people get really sort of, some people get annoyed if an online recipe has too much story, like, get to the recipe, but cookbooks are different. I want the story, and I feel like some of the cookbooks we've talked about on the podcast, and they're just so rich with story, and that's the beauty of them.
Right.
I have two today. The first one is
I just love the look of it. It's so beautiful. It's called Keep It Zesty by Edie Massey, a celebration of Lebanese flavors and cultures from Edie's Grocer. And Edie's Grocer is a store, a little grocery store and restaurant in Brooklyn. And this story has a really great story of his childhood growing up in a little fishing village in Lebanon. It's actually a largely Greek Orthodox village. And his tetes, his grandmothers, who were so dear to him, from one was Syrian, one was Lebanese, and just how his family moves to Boston, the political climate, they can tell it's not the best, and they need to go. And they go to the United States. And a really kind of fun part of this book is his love of Oprah. And he has a whole piece about how, as a young child in Lebanese, he was closeted and Oprah was sort of like, spoke to him. I don't know, like gave him some sort of, something to sort of hold on to. And he felt, he was closeted until after high school. And he had to move to the United States, play in all these sports teams and that sort of thing. He always kind of felt left out or kind of felt out of place. And then he ends up, you know, finding himself in cooking and baking. And again, this little tribute to Oprah is just really beautiful and how much she meant to him. But he gets a culinary degree, but during COVID, he ends up having trouble with his catering business because of, you know, everything that happened. And they have an opportunity to start this restaurant. And so it's just wonderful recipes. I love Lebanese food. We have a lot of really great Lebanese restaurants in the area. So we are so fortunate here to have so many wonderful options. But there's some really great recipes, something called Fete, Six Ways, which is like a chickpea base and all these different variations. He has a wonderful shawarma spice recipe. The baked
goods. That's my first question to her. Is there a shawarma spice recipe?
It was. This salty chocolate tahini cookie just sounds amazing. And it's a beautiful book and really fun and zesty. It shows pictures of Edie's Grocer, and it's got sort of like pink and green motif, which is just fantastic. Very 80s, because that was the thing in 1984. Pink and green. Brings me right back. So I loved it. The other one is a tome. You could use it as a doorstop or a cookbook.
That is massive.
It is useful for many reasons. Baking in the American South, 200 Recipes and Their Untold Stories by Ann Byrne. And when I first saw this, I was like, Ann Byrne? She's the cake mix doctor. Do you remember the cake mix doctor books? I mean, they were like really big in our libraries. And it was like taking a cake mix and doctoring it. But she is a classically trained, you know, pastry chef. She was a food writer in Atlanta for years, and she's sort of a food historian. What I love about this book is it warms my librarian heart in every possible way because it's a work of scholarship. I mean, to be able to pull something like this together, she combed through historic cookbooks, archives. She asked people for regional recipes, and it's this 200 recipes, tons of photographs, lots of historical information, with this huge bibliography. I think I counted it was 8 pages of bibliography of other books to look at, to launch into. But we have Zora Neale Hurston, we have Eudora Welty in here, we have TV media personalities, current chefs, everything you can kind of almost think of, including her own family recipes. So it's just absolutely beautiful. We have molasses cornbread for Zora Neale Hurston. And the historical pieces are really, really interesting. Melinda Russell's lemon drizzle loaves. I'm always kind of a sucker for a lemon pound cake. And it just always looks so good to me.
Any kind of pound cake, thank you.
Yeah, and there's something about that always draws me. But this is actually from a cookbook called The Domestic Cookbook, which is considered the first U.S. cookbook authored by a black woman. And actually, a University of Michigan historian and antique cookbook collector worked on the project to sort of restore. So that's a lot of what this cookbook is. It's family recipes, but it's also bringing and unearthing recipes that have been buried or hidden and just talking about cookbook creators. It's fun.
Beautiful.
It's wonderful. Aunt Elizabeth's banana pudding. This is her aunt and talks a lot about banana pudding, which is something I'm not really that familiar with because I am not Southern really in any way. I know people have banana pudding here, but I think it was just a really fun book. George Washington Carver's sliced sweet potato pie. Peanut pie. So it goes through a range of Southern cookbook recipes and just looks really fun.
I have to compare grandma's and the pound cake to dad's pound cake.
Yeah.
Or grandma's pound cake.
Yeah.
I'm curious now.
Yeah, see?
Yeah. And speaking of local history, I feel like the historical aspect of that, I should point out that our local history branch has a zine out called Obsolete, made by Ben Ackley, who is my partner, so I'm intimately aware with this whole thing. But it's a zine that he made pulling recipes from the archive here at Cattle, and it's put together in a little collage format with all sorts of things that he pulled out. Lots of things that you would actually want to eat and lots of things you maybe would want to skip over. There's a eat at your own risk section with like laxative candy and circus peanut salad and raccoon meatloaf.
Circus peanut salad.
All sorts of things. So
alrighty,
he's offering that. I mean, it's at all the branches have copies of it available for free, and it's around town as well. But they have a mailing list you can sign up for. We can include the link to that in the meeting notes and get the latest zines. So
fascinating. Yes.
Cool. I love that because she talks here about how local cookbooks were really key.
You know? Oh, yeah. And certainly.
One of them had this introduction by Eudora Welty. It just happened to, you know, it was just like one of those things. But how much, I mean, how much food is our heritage, is our history? It's those family gatherings. It's everything, really. Yeah. So
very much.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a last pass.
Yeah.
Ready? Got one more?
I have one picture book. I'm always on the lookout for especially autumn-themed or fall books at this time of year. And this one came across because of the cover with the leaves that look sort of autumn-like. Next Level, A Hymn in Gratitude for Neurodiversity. It's written by Samara Cole Doyen, and it's illustrated by Kehlani Juanita. Wow, what a lovely, lovely book. This story is about a mom who is honoring her son, who is autistic, has autism. And, you know, the beginning part is, you know, it just shows, like, you know, experiences that maybe families who have children who have autism are, you know, experiencing, where, like, people look at you or they're just kind of, like, in a tiny way, just not totally approving. And this is like she's like celebrating her son all out. And also just being really grateful for that experience. We center so much on what we think is the perfect family or the perfect experience to grow up as a child. And everything we have is a blessing. And just, I was really, really blown away by this book. And so she says, because nothing can hold you back when you cut through the wind. You're on the next level. You feel everything. And she's celebrating that. Her son, who is stimming or flapping or experiencing life in a way that maybe most of us do not. So
I love that. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I couldn't be more happy about the number of books that are coming out that are neurodiversity positive. I'm sad that they didn't come out sooner and that this perspective wasn't vocalized in literature sooner.
I
see it in adult nonfiction and memoir.
And
it's a shift and a wholly 100% necessary shift. And
absolutely.
I love that it's in picture books
very
too
much.
It's just wow, thank you. I'm going to go quickly with one of the books that was on my have-to-read-it-this-year book list, which is about, like, 700 books or something.
Yeah, I was
going to
say,
impossible.
It's not going to happen, but.
But I got to this one.
This one worked.
Yes. It's A Passionate Mind and Relentless Pursuit, The Vision of Mary McLeod Bethune by Nola Way Rooks, who is a professor of Africana Studies at Brown University and probably one of the best nonfiction writers I've read. I feel like this is a... it's a slim book, which is unusual in adult nonfiction, and I'm seeing more of that a little bit, which I'm happy about.
Yes.
It cuts right to the heart of the topic, but also includes some of her own personal story, which is uniquely intertwined with the history of Mary McLeod Bethune. And while it's a historical biography, it is really an inspiration for current activism and for picking up this torch and continuing with the efforts of Mary McLeod Bethune. And she lamented about how Mary McLeod Bethune has sort of drifted into history and isn't as celebrated or known as she should be. I won't say everything that she's done. I'd like to encourage you to read the book, but I do want to say I cannot believe this woman had one lifetime. She lived...
Or slept.
Yeah, or slept. She was 80 years old. That was a long lifetime, and I don't know how she slept. She did almost everything that you can think of in areas of civil rights that included education, healthcare, youth development, advocacy. She helped serve when the UN was founded. She was in FDR's black cabinet. She founded the National Council of Negro Women. She was the vice president of the NAACP. This is just scratching the surface. She started a school for girls that became Bethune-Cookman University. And again, that's not it. Okay, it's just, it blows you away. She was considered and called the First Lady of Black America. Her own sort of obituary that she wrote, which is beautiful and is in this book and inspiring, was featured in Ebony magazine. She has two monuments, including one in the, I believe, in the Capitol building. So it's just an incredible book and a slim, quick read, and I couldn't really recommend it more. So,
okay, my last one is one of those, stop and hear me out. I will tell you, and actually I think both of you are around, or at least knew about when I was buying this book. It's called The Nightmare Before Christmas by Sarah Rosch.
Oh, boy.
I showed them the cover. I looked at the description, and I absolutely looked at this and thought, who let this get through? Just add to the fact that it is one of those, the new publishing trend is to paint the block, and it's in that romanticy style marketing, which is driving me insane. They can be pretty, but they just don't make great library books to me. They don't wear well. But this is, I was pleasantly surprised. It's a fun, it doesn't take itself too seriously, romantic comedy in the style of Casey McQuiston's Red, White, and Royal Blue and The Nightmare Before Christmas. it's a prince of Christmas and a prince of Halloween. Buttheads find love. There's a lot of banter. There's a lot of bizarreness to this. There's magic, of course, because Christmas, Halloween. I spent a lot of time wanting to throw things at Santa Claus because he was just, it's very reminiscent of listening, you know, thinking about Charlie Brown's Why Is This All So Commercial? And it feels like Santa's making everything commercial. it's a very quirky, fun, doesn't take itself too seriously holiday read. And I was pleasant. I really was. It's that moment of sort of seeing it and thinking, oh God, this can't be good, but I really got to know. Yeah. So I got the advanced reading copy of it. And it is actually a good book. And I did enjoy it. And I do suggest it.
And something light and enjoyable could be very lovely right now.
Yes,
you know, it is
could.
November in 2024.
It could. I mean,
so.
It's got its moments of, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's going to be the first in a series. There's other characters that Sarah Rosch can play with, and this is, I think, her first adult book. Mm. And it's they're young. They're like it's college age, like just post college age, but it's still it's an angsty new adult romance. Featuring princes of the holidays. So, and some very bad, bad, bad Christmas puns. It's just lots of bad Christmas
content
puns.
Content warning Christmas so. Puns.
You know, I don't know about our listeners, but I'm enjoying not having the theme because I feel like this has been a really fun mix of books. Like, we've got a little bit of everything.
Yes, here. We do. Yes, we do.
We're very across the board today.
Yeah. Yep. All right. And I think that's what we have.
All right.
So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Enjoy your reading journey, and we'll see you next month.
All right.